More music. Better mental health. Only on IPL Radio.
That's right, you're listening to IPL Radio and it's Mish and Good Vibrations with Mish. I've got a studio of wonderful people in here and I go around the table.
River.
We have River. River's just got such a sexy voice.
Lana.
And I've got a great guest in here. It's Mark O'Hare from SFV, which is Stopping Family Violence and Positive Place. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me in.
It's been like, we've been trying to set this up since December last year, right?
Yes.
Yeah, because we met at, we did a Christmas drinks with Paul Farrelly.
Yes.
And I've literally probably met you for about 30 seconds and then I had to leave.
Yes.
And then we've been trying to set this up since.
Yep, it was a great 30 seconds.
It was a great. That's what they all say.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you got that one. All right, so thank you so much for coming in, and I appreciate it that you've finally come in for us. I know you're a very, very busy man, and you've come from Vic Park, so I appreciate that. Now, where do we start? Do you want to talk about your two businesses, or do you have a personal story you'd like to discuss? Or I'm going to leave it up to you because this is your time.
Okay.
Where do you want to go with this?
Either or, I guess. I suppose, could I be bold and just talk a little bit about myself?
Yeah, why not? Absolutely. Please. I would love to hear that.
That's okay, yeah. So I did social work. So social work's my background almost 20 years ago now. I probably need to start to add on a year or two a few times. So I did social work and that really, I guess, certainly introduced me into the work of counselling.
Okay.
And very quickly I worked in areas for really counselling in for clients through child protection or real kind of social work traditional roles. Mm-hmm. So it might have been in hospital and then I worked a lot with those that are in prison.
Okay.
And coming out of prison on parole and on different community-based orders.
Mm-hmm.
I actually worked in that area for a good solid 10 years, really. Really in that area for clients that were really kind of within the justice system, actually.
Okay. All right.
But what I realized and recognized is that there are obviously so many people that do not go through that system and need support.
They either get lost in the system if they're in the system, or they get lost because they don't even get into the system. Is that what you're saying?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we know that with mental health, one of the huge things is that reaching out of actually talking of actually who do people go to, and if people aren't in the system, it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
And, you add on layers of stigma or what that means if I do reach out.
That's right.
Think of me. And so I really was looking around, and probably about 8 years ago to when I was thinking about Positive Place and the business, etc. The work that I was in with government at the time, there were services for those staff to be able to reach out.
Okay.
External services for those staff to be reach out. What I noticed is that with small businesses or medium businesses, there wasn't that service for staff to be able to reach out.
Okay.
So I just kind of recognized it, I suppose.
There was a gap.
As a bit of a gap.
Yeah.
That there are so many people that actually really could do with just talking, actually.
Exactly.
With somebody that is maybe not related to them or doesn't know them on a personal level, so they can just reach out and a non-judgmental person could sit down and have a conversation,
Some people they don't necessarily need you to say anything. They just want to be able to tell their story without any judgment whatsoever, and no, you don't need to give an advice. They just want to be heard.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that what you do?
Pretty much. And I found out pretty quickly that there's, a lot of people have not really ever experienced counselling.
No.
Again, there's a stigma on it.
Definitely. Definitely.
I'm seeing somebody, that means
I'm going to be lying on a couch and,
Totally.
Yeah.
So Positive Place was born from really providing an opportunity for businesses to, not only their staff to have support, but the business owners to have a support and to be able to reach out really at any time, the things that might be impacting on them that might be happening at work, but to be honest, most of the time it's not.
I was going to ask that because my husband's FIFO, and he also has a place that he can ring for assistance if he needs any mental health assistance. But and there's things we've been going through recently, and I've been saying to him, you really should ring them. But he said, but it's not work-related. I said, but I don't think it matters whether it's work-related. And but there is a stigma. He's worried that people are going to find out. It's going to go to the bosses. They're going to find out. Is it very confidential?
It is confidential. And, you know, the service that you're talking about sounds like an employee assistance program.
That, yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
so 100%. And I'd recommend that if there are people listening to really reach out to those services. These are professionals that are in those positions to really support staff. Really recognize
and it's confidential. It can't go any further than what they're listening to.
It is confidential.
Do they have to write, reports? Is there anything going to be written down?
No. So it certainly doesn't get back to the manager. So what I recognised when I was in government organisation was that certainly has its place, and I certainly would recommend employees to utilise that as a resource to talk about whatever might be impacting them. For myself, a positive place, I just go that step further, I guess. And so I go into businesses, I run workshops with the whole team.
Oh, good.
I'll go, walk away from the office with staff. So, for example, I call it a walk and talk.
Okay.
Me, the staff member, or a business owner, and we just go for a walk.
Okay. Right?
And a good example was yesterday. A dad reached out, an employer, and he's really struggling at the moment with one of his children, one of his teenage children, who's been diagnosed with ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And him and his partner really, really struggling with, parenting, with the behavioural stuff, blaming themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
They're talking about now they're starting to argue with each other.
Oh, right. It's your fault. Like, it's your fault. It must be you.
All that stuff. Yeah. Right? So it's impacting on them. Now, it's not got anything to do with the workplace. Nothing to do with the workplace. But really important. And, of course, that's going to impact on him. Being able to do the best job you can within the workplace.
Yeah, of course.
Well.
Yeah.
And just, be the best partner, be the best dad.
A lot of pressure.
So, so positive place is just providing that opportunity for.
That's
for
brilliant. What I see is that type of thing would be offered to white collar. Do you work with people on the floor? For example, let's say FIFO, again, because this is the area that I know, they tend to offer things like this to white-collar worker, but the people on the floor and getting dirty always sort of thought of last, and they're the ones that are working really hard physically, mentally. Sure. So do you work with – is it just work white-collar that you work with?
No, it's anything. Business, yeah. And a couple of things that I really want to emphasise here is that it's the whole team. And the business owner or the manager needs to be on board that it is for the whole team. So I go in and do workshops for the whole team. I reach out individually to everybody.
Okay, good.
Make little videos for people.
Yeah, okay.
And it might be, somebody might not reach out for 6 months or a year.
Yeah.
And an example, just got a message in the week from a staff member saying, hey, you're apparently the guy that I can reach out and talk to. And got back and we caught up actually just this morning and had a
that's
really,
awesome
really,
yeah so it's very inclusive then
incredibly inclusive
yeah that's yes. good that's yeah. really good that's really good
and in fact that's a large part of the workshops is to support that inclusivity that when you talk about white collar or when you talk about particular people or whatever etc. often people look through their lenses and they think everybody else looks through their lenses. And so this perspective taking that we are all different and to really value differences and to really value inclusivity and really just that, I don't know, it sounds corny, but really from a real kind of a human standpoint that we are all equally worthwhile no matter what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. That's really 100%. Good. I just want to go back to your, because you've been in this for a long time. Did you study in this area?
Yep, so social work.
You did social work studies. Okay. Was that something you did straight from school?
No, actually, I.
I'm getting a bit deep now.
Yeah, go. Let's deep dive. Yeah, no, I was 25 when I went to over here.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were? What, can I ask what you did before that?
Yep, I was a stripper. No, sorry, couldn't help it. Sorry. No, it was actually a completely different life as a veterinary nurse.
No, really?
Yeah.
Gosh, that is one extreme to another.
It is.
But it is caring. It's still helping people and animals. Yeah.
Yeah, hugely. And actually, you know, that's a good point, really, is picking up that, you know, I think there's this kind of, this image of the veterinary world being really happy, of being puppies, being be amazing, being da 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 da.
Mm.
But actually, there's a lot of sadness.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And, you know, pets can be, and often are, you know, one of the key family members.
Absolutely.
Right?
And, yeah.
And when we're
talking
about trauma and we're talking
heartbreaking.
About, you know, really kind of plays a huge part in people's lives with that. And so actually, I saw a lot of people coming in. Very unhappy.
So they needed the help rather than the animal itself.
Yeah. So I think there was a part of me that really kind of started to evolve to want to connect more to
the human.
To the humans, right?
That's awesome.
As well as
the animals. That's awesome.
So
good for you.
That's a good point, yeah,
good for you. So you've gone from animals to the worst animals on the earth, which is the humans. What's easier? Animals can't talk back at you, but they can bite.
They can bite, but depends how philosophically we're talking. Some people can bite too, right?
Yeah, so true that. And they can bite nasty.
Yeah.
They can be nasty.
Yeah. Look, I don't... That's a really tough question, you know? I think, you know, at the end of the day, yeah, I feel more connected to certainly the work that I'm doing
with people.
But... You know, give me an animal and...
Because you worked in the prison system before. That would be hard.
It was hard. And, you know, certainly hearing some really, really, you know, tough stories.
Yeah.
And often working with people that at a stage of life that might not want the help.
Okay.
You know, not really recognise the impact their behaviours are having. You know, on others, even though they're sitting in prison.
Yeah.
Even though their families are destroyed.
Yep.
You know, it can still be this kind of level of resistance
of,
if I truly accept that what I've done, then I truly have to accept with what comes with that.
Okay.
So, but shifting to a positive piece, a really, really incredibly rewarding. You know, people going through different journeys
and
coming out the other side.
Definitely.
Walk alongside them at those
absolutely
times.
I'm a support worker as well, so that's what I do is for work, so the reward is definitely more rewarding than the dollar itself. I don't do it for the dollar, I do it for the reward in the end. It's an amazing feeling. I taught a totally blind kid to swim and it was just the best thing I've ever done in my life. The reward was huge. Huge. It was just brilliant.
Well,
so yeah, I do understand that. So now you talk to people about their issues or the things that they're going through. Who do you have to talk to?
That's another good question. You know, I've got friends. With my position and with my work, there is clinical supervision, so I do see somebody professionally myself on a regular basis, and that's for exactly that. You know, what am I taking on? What do I think I may have done well and not so well? So that's a kind of a formal process. But, you know, it's really important for me to really recognise those early signs, whether it's burnout or impact on my mental health. And I guess in no way perfect, but I've tried to be as much as attuned to those early warning signs
that good.
My mental health is slipping a little bit.
Yeah.
And that might be little things like I'm watching Netflix in bed, you know.
Okay.
A lot more than I did before.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And I
yeah.
need that now before I go to sleep.
Okay.
Oh, I'll go, hang on a minute. This is a checkpoint.
Something's not, yeah, that's good. That's really good. That's really good.
All those little things are the early pieces before it gets to a point of.
Yeah. I'm an empathic. Is it empathic? Is that the right word? So I empath. I take on everyone's hurt, worry, and I find it really hard to cut that off. And that's something that I'm having to deal with and having to learn how to do. Particularly as a support worker, it can be quite difficult because I'll go home and worry about that person, which I shouldn't be doing. Yeah, that's so. I need to learn that. But you probably learned that through your studies anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess you'd probably be able to reflect on your early warning signs when you're starting to go.
I can more now. As I get older, I think it's easier. Because I do suffer from anxiety and depression anyway. So I'm learning to know those triggers and to know where I am dropping. Whereas probably even 10 years ago, I wasn't able to do so. But, yeah, it does get easier as you get older. I just wish I'd known that stuff now that I should have known when I was 20. It would have been so much easier. Life would have been easier.
Can confirm it doesn't help knowing these things sometimes when you're in the middle of it.
Doesn't it?
I've been told for years that I'm really self-aware and all that kind of stuff, which just means you don't get support.
Oh, because they think you're okay.
And I was like, you seem to have such good insight. And it's like, well, yeah, but I need help.
Oh.
And, you know, like you can be on the verge of death and they'll be like, well, you seem to have it, you know, sorted. Your head screwed on. And it's like, well, obviously I don't because I'm sitting here with you. But
have you actually physically asked for help?
Oh,
have you ever? Countless times. Have you? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been in the mental health system since I was 12.
Yeah,
so,
okay. And you've struggled with that and still do.
Yeah, not so much these days. Like, I think being in recovery is a huge step. Like, especially being in residential rehab, like, I actually figured out how to do the human thing a lot better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you do a lot of training as well. You get a lot of lessons, a lot of education.
Yeah.
Which is obviously extremely beneficial to you.
Mm.
And I think then you would learn your triggers. You're learning your triggers. You're learning those times where, oh, hang on, I'm not actually feeling the best today. In fact, you've come in here and said, look, I'm not feeling the best today.
Yeah, I'm a lot more vocal about, like, I need. Like, I've been able to set myself, like, as to what my needs are. And, like, and I can tell, like you said, with the early warning signs, like, I know I'm personally, like, I've got all these good things happening, but I'm also not traveling that well in terms of self-care and looking after myself and all that. So I can see that can easily snowball if I'm not careful.
Yeah.
So, like, I've got to kind of rein it in sometime soon.
Yeah, okay.
So that's why, you know, like,
But because you're clean and going through rehab, you're clear in your head anyway. So there's things about hygiene and stuff like that you probably wouldn't even thought about when you're using your drugs or something like that. Whereas you're now clear and that this is something I should be doing.
Yeah.
Is that real? Like,
I mean, like, there's been a lot of times in my life where I've had, like, I know, you know, especially when I used to be insomniac, so I know a lot about, like, sleep hygiene and sleep patterns and all that kind of stuff. But, like, actually doing them, it's a lot easier to actually, like, my conscience is a lot louder in recovery.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like one thing, like, I've known, you know, how to look after myself better for a long time, and I've done it for periods of my life, but consistently doing it is something that I'm trying to get a handle on,
because
that's, I think, the key to actually having a functional and full life is to actually look after yourself first and foremost.
Absolutely. Yeah. We all need to learn that. Definitely. Definitely. So, Mark, you're doing that. That's positive, positive place. The other one that you've got is the SFV, which is Stopping Family Violence. This is something that I don't have any background in this whatsoever. Can you clarify or give us some background on what this is? How did it start? Why did it start? Go for it.
Yeah, sure. So, so SFV, or Stopping Family Violence, is the peak body in Western Australia for perpetrator response work. So what that means is that Stopping Family Violence is not necessarily a service provider, so not necessarily running the programs themselves, but actually partnering with organizations that work in the area for domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So that might be police or child protection or Department of Justice or health or mental health, etc. And so when I talk about work in the area for domestic violence, yes, it might be specifically around family domestic violence, but also all the other organizations that work with families that might intersect in some way with family domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So somebody might be using substances and go to a substance abuse program, but actually they may also be perpetrating family domestic violence.
Yeah, okay.
Or they may also be experiencing family domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So although those organizations are not specialist organizations around family domestic violence,
they're We usually have some link.
Having conversations with men, women, everybody really around, potentially family domestic violence.
Yeah.
So health, so hospital is a good example that, people are going to hospital for many, many different reasons, and then many people who are going there that may also be experiencing family domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
and also many people that may be going there that are also perpetrating
violence.
So how can those services have what we call really partnering conversations with those that are experiencing family domestic violence,
mm.
and how can they support those that are choosing to use the violence to shift some of their attitudes, shift some of their beliefs, and promote some accountability actually for their behaviour.
Very delicate area.
It is a very delicate area, yeah. And one of the key themes is for stopping family violence is to really, really focus in on the cause of the harm. And that might seem really obvious in this space, but actually what often happens in family domestic violence is those that are experiencing the family domestic violence get actually the spotlight put on them to actually create safety for themselves and for their children. And, an example might be, let me go back a bit. So to shift society's expectations or perceptions around family domestic violence. So it might be that, let me think of an example. So you might have conversations around a water cooler or in the office or at a party, and you might have a conversation to somebody and you're telling them about somebody that's experiencing family domestic violence.
Mm.
Say it's a woman that's experiencing family domestic violence in this case, right? So you're telling this person that she's experiencing the and you're talking about the experience that she's having, she's got children, and more often than not what comes back is, why doesn't she leave?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Or if I was in that situation, I would have left.
That's the first thing. Yep.
Right? But very rarely what comes back is, why doesn't he stop?
Oh, okay. Yeah, good point.
So this real shift in the narrative really we need to be shifting to, because actually if you go to that language straight away of why doesn't he stop, you start talking about the person's behaviours and it might be that, it's a thing called coercively controlling, it might be that he takes the car, it might be that he threatens to harm her, it might be that he does this thing called love bombing, saying that he won't do it again. If you promise he won't do this again. It was a one-off. So all these.
What did you call that? Love bombing.
Love bombing.
Oh, love bombing.
Love bombing.
Okay. Yeah.
So actually, when you start to talk about the person that's choosing the violence and all those behaviours, actually, then you go back to, oh, why did she leave? Well, it's pretty obvious actually why she doesn't leave, because of all those behaviours.
Mm.
And so really kind of gathering a better understanding of family domestic violence, that the whole purpose for somebody that's perpetrating family domestic violence is to stop the person from leaving.
Okay.
Is to force the person to stay.
Yep.
And so we have these two differences, societal kind of expectation of like, why don't you leave?
Yeah.
But actually the whole purpose of that person perpetrating is to stop the person from leaving.
Yeah, absolutely.
And somebody describes family domestic violence often as more like kidnapping than a series of violent offences.
Yeah.
And if you describe it as kidnapping, you straight away think, would you ever ask a kidnappee, why didn't you leave?
Yeah.
You wouldn't.
You can't. Yeah, you're kidnapped.
You wouldn't ask a kidnappee, why didn't you leave? It seems ludicrous, right?
Yeah.
But we ask somebody who's trapped in a family domestic with a family domestic violence perpetrator, why don't you leave?
That's a good way of putting it. Decision. Yeah, that's a really good way
of
putting it.
Yeah, I asked my mum. Like, I had a lot of trouble with that as a kid. Like, I grew up in a pretty violent home myself. So, like, that was something that experience for the first, 13. Well, most of my young life until I was an adult, because my brother continued it after we left my dad. And, like, that's something I really struggle with, because, like, kids don't understand that. They think it's, like, I remember when I was, I don't remember this instance. My mum told me about it a few years later, but apparently when I was, like, 7 or 8, my mum and dad had this massive fight, and mum went to walk the dogs, and I like followed her to the park, and I was just walking with her. We were just walking in silence. Like, when she told me about it, it kind of jogged my memory. But like, apparently I just like out of the blue just asked her, I was like, why don't you get a divorce? And like, I'm the youngest in the family, so like that was a pretty like, jarring thing for her apparently. And like, yeah, like I always struggle with that. Like, why don't we just both. But mum always had the thing of like, you know, like she never wanted to go on Centrelink, she never wanted to do all that kind of stuff. Like she was always working like 2-3 jobs or like all that kind of stuff. So
I guess
didn't understand like what when you're a kid all you think is, oh, my mum's never here and I'm getting beat up all the time, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah.
So like it's hard to it's hard to have, like I always say, as I got older I got the compassion and understanding that like you know, of the situation, and like I'm a lot closer with my mum now, but like for a long time there it was like I think even
did you blame her?
Not really.
For working all those hours and leaving you?
A little bit for the work, but not for this, not for the situation.
Okay.
Like I guess maybe in that like petulant child kind of way you think like why'd you pick him?
Yeah, okay.
You know,
like,
but like my dad is a master manipulator and he puts on a really good front. He's like was always like very involved in the community and all that kind of stuff.
Worst.
Like putting his best foot forward in any other space other than the family.
They call them narcissists, don't they?
Yeah, massively narcissistic, manipulative kind of person. So and I guess because like I cut contact with my dad after we moved away from him, he still followed us to our new house and like stalked my mum from work and would always barge into our house and stuff. But I didn't actively have contact with him since I was like 13. And but like because my mum was there and I was still living with mum, like I didn't have like I think all the anger and stuff that come from growing up in that kind of environment and the fact that it continued with my brother and stuff, like I didn't have anywhere to direct it.
Okay.
And, like, I think because mum had also been in the kind of violent situation for so long, like, she'd become, like, very... She was always very passive. She didn't know how to, like, stand up to that kind of, like, behaviour and stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, it would, and, like, especially with my brother, it would always be like, oh, you know, like, that's my son, you know? Like, and the worst of it, he was very similar to my dad. He would do the worst of it
When
no one was around to see it. So,
No.
Like, I'd say it and be like, no, you're overreacting, you're being too dramatic and all that kind of stuff. So, obviously, I had a lot of bitterness around that kind of stuff because it's very like, invalidating and all that. So, I just, that's when I started, like, living out of home and, like, couch surfing and stuff because it was just like,
well, that's the only way you could control it.
No one's listening to this, you know, like no one's...
Yeah. Wow, so, that's interesting.
But yeah, I get the... Yeah, that's a it's a good shift to try and focus
it
on.
It is, because...
The perpetrator, because like, it's a, you know, like saying why don't you leave him doesn't exactly like solve the issue because it probably just means they're going
to
find
someone
else.
Somebody else,
ruin the life of.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I want to know, with family violence, how much is religion involved?
Yeah, and I think...
cultural religion.
Yeah, what you're touching on there, I guess, are, you know, factors that provide opportunities for those that perpetrate family domestic violence to use it to their advantage to further oppress their partner.
Correct, yeah.
So, and these are... You know, I guess there's a word, intersectionalities, which is these multiple forms of oppression that can be used to further oppress the partner or family.
Oh, right.
And so religion, certainly, or spirituality, and how do they use that to, you know, maybe stop their partner from leaving or stop their partner from disclosing. And, you know, an example of that might be, you know, often with religion, there's a huge community. That's a huge life, right?
Yeah.
And if that's impacted, then that's a huge impact on the family. And one example a survivor shared was that a partner of the perpetrator had compromising photographs of her.
Oh, no.
And threatened to send those photographs to the church group.
Oh, no.
If she ever
said
was
anything.
To disobey him.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Or to leave. And so I guess there's an example of using religion as a real powerful tool that he didn't need to lay a hand on her.
No.
But that threat lay
that was enough.
That
yeah.
was enough.
Wow.
And so, you know, what you're touching on there I think is really powerful.
Yeah,
is
definitely.
How is somebody using, whether it's, spirituality or religion, and if we don't look at those factors, then we will go to, oh, why don't you leave?
Yeah,
you know,
it's
sure
the first thing.
Her,
yeah,
well, why don't you leave? But actually, there's a reason
she can't because
they would know why she
and she could never tell anybody the reason why she couldn't leave.
That's right.
Yeah, wow, that's right. Really interesting to look at it from that point of view, because media shows the victim, but never shows the perpetrator, or the spotlight isn't on the perpetrator. It's always on the victim.
That's right, yeah.
Wow.
There's often, yeah, that's a really good point. There's often more emphasis placed on the victim than the perpetrator.
Yeah, I mean, rightly so. That, you know, that there should also be, you know, a spotlight on the victim, but we never look at it from, or I've never had to look at it from the purpose, I can't even say the word. You can say it.
The perpetrator.
Perpetrator, yeah. That's it. Yeah. Point of view, because, yeah, exactly. If they leave, like you were saying, Lana, someone else is just going to fill that gap.
Mm.
And it's just going to continue and continue and continue. They're going to have kids and they'll continue and continue and continue. Wow.
Yeah.
That's scary.
It is scary. And I guess what you're touching on there is really we need to challenge this kind of myth statement that separation creates safety. You know, like you just shared there, even though, you know, you moved out, doesn't mean that you were necessarily safer, right?
Yeah. No. No, like within a week, like he would be waiting out in the car park where mum works and stuff and like follow her home. So, and every time we moved house, he would find out within a couple of weeks, even though I think he had sporadic contact with my brother and sister and never really like had that information. He would just, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, it's very interesting.
Important to note at this point that, you know, women are at the most risk of homicide, actually, at the time of leaving.
Really?
Is that at the most risk time.
Wow.
So again, we have this, why don't you leave? When actually the statistics and the research clearly shows that actually a time of leaving can be the most dangerous time.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
For a woman who's living with somebody who's choosing to abuse.
Wow.
Do you guys work with police as well? Because, like, I know, like, I've got quite a few people in my life that have grown up in similar environments to me and, like, pretty widespread throughout all experiences is that police weren't particularly helpful in any way, shape or form. Like one of my earliest memories of like a violent situation in my home would have been when we still lived in Sydney, and I would have been about 4 or 5 years old, and I remember like my dad threatening my mum with a belt and stuff, and then she called the police. I think that was the first time she'd called the police, and neither of my parents really spoke much English at this point still. So she called the police, they came to the house, and my dad answered the door, and like he spoke to them for about 30 seconds. I remember standing there and seeing them through the gap in the chain.
Oh, wow.
And like, spoke to them for about 30 seconds. They didn't ask my mum any questions. They didn't do anything about it. And like from that experience, like mum's always had a thing of just like never called the police, never... You know, because it's not a help. They don't, like, the system isn't there to help people that way.
Yeah.
Like, that's not what it's there for. Like, and that's something I've heard, like, different kind of experiences around that, like, throughout a lot of people that I know in my life that have been in similar situations. Like, that's why there's a lot of, I guess, disdain for police in, I guess, like, lower socioeconomic kind of areas.
I think a lot of people, too, would be... nervous about ringing the police because the neighbours are going to find out something's going on. I can't do that. We could talk about this for hours.
Yeah.
And it's definitely something that I would like to be more educated on. If someone out there that's listening now is in a domestic violence situation, what would be the suggestion that they should take?
There's a number of... support numbers. There's the women's DV helpline.
Mm-hmm.
There's the men's DV helpline. There's a national number, 1-800-RESPECT.
Mm-hmm. What about for a person who has that male figure that's very controlling and will know that phone call has been made from their phone?
Yeah.
How can they ring without being known that they've rung that number? Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
What would they do in that case?
And, you know, it, I guess it's very individual.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Where that person is at. And
family and friends would have to be involved.
Friend, it might be somebody else that might be able to support. But, you know, I always, you know, kind of want to put it out there that those are experiencing family domestic violence. We need to also trust that they are experts in managing their own safety, and often they have been for a long time.
For a long time, yeah.
And want to encourage, you know, both sides, actually, those that might be experiencing it, but also those that might be hearing as well. There's a lot of stigma. There's a lot of kind of like, and I just picked up what you were saying in regards to your dad. He was, you know, the token within the
community. Yeah.
Other people thought he was great, etc. And what that means then, if somebody was going to reach out, if mom was going to reach out, how they might believed her or not in that space. So I really want to put it out there. We always need to believe people when they do say,
I'm
experiencing this and experiencing that. That's the number one.
Good.
We need to believe people that are going to disclose this.
Yeah.
And the number two is that, you know, yes, people might have a negative experience from time with services, but that doesn't necessarily mean the next service is going to be like that. And so really encourage still to really use the services.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, as well. It does come down to the individual.
I totally respect that. Yeah. That's challenging and for good reason as well.
Yeah. And it's amazing you could remember that at such a young age, Lana.
Yeah, it's one of my earliest memories.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We have to finish there, Mark. This has gone so quickly. If anyone wanted to contact you, is there any way? Who would need to ring you or contact you? What type of people? Businesses, etc.
Yep. So, across if it's Positive Place, really any business. You know, I can't recommend it enough for people just to reach out, and that's mark@positiveplace.com.au really to provide a service for the staff and for themselves, actually, for business owners to talk in this space.
Yep.
If it's related to family domestic violence, it's admin@sfv.org.au.
Brilliant. It's awesome. Every time someone comes in here, I learn more, and I love it. It's just educating and learning about these sort of things, because they're not involved in my life, but we need to know that this sort of stuff happens. Because if someone was next to me and they needed help, I would have a better understanding on how to help them.
Even if you just say, why don't you leave?
Don't say, why don't you leave? Yeah.
That itself could be huge.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate you coming in. It's been fantastic. Finally, you've come in, which is great. Yes,
thank you.
You can come in anytime and chat if you ever wanted to come back. You're very, very welcome to come into IPL. I'm an 80s freak, so I'm going to play some 80s music.
Right.
And I'm actually going to play some Police. Now, we were talking about this last week. The do-do-do-do-do. Yeah. They do have a song called do 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 da da da, and this is it. Thanks, Mark.